I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Everybody, and welcome to minute 90 of season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off the week is Emily Graziano of the Flapperdame Film Blog. Welcome back to the show, Emily.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been really, really fun just discussing all of these 5 minutes of It's a Wonderful Life and just learning things that you might not think about, topics related to this movie. So it's just been so much fun, and I've learned so much, and it's still not over yet. So that's always the best part about it all.
That's right. We still got another minute to discuss this week, and obviously you can keep coming back next week and the week after. We still have, we're actually hitting the 90 minute mark of this movie, and we still have another 42 minutes to go. You know, there's still a lot more that's going to happen here. We haven't even gotten to the main point of this movie. You know, that we still have another few weeks till we get to, which it's a great build up. There's no question about that. You know, it feels like a snowball.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it's snowballing, and it's making everything get bigger and bigger and bigger until at one point it's going to just basically explode. I love the way they do this. So minute 90 begins with George continuing to bless Zuzu and ends with George answering angrily to whoever is actually on the phone. So yesterday we finished with George being in the room with Zuzu, and he's sort of blessing her, you know, as he's after he convinces her that she needs to stay in bed and rest. Now, did you happen to notice before we really only have literally a second in this minute dealing with George in the room. Did you notice that there is a game leaning against the wall between Zuzu's bed and the crib?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so there's a game there. The only thing I could see that's written on it is Stick'em, but it has basically a bullseye. So what I am envisioning or imagining is there is it reminds me of, I remember as a kid, we used to have, we would have a dartboard that was made of Velcro, you know, and it was, you threw Velcro balls at the dartboard instead of throwing darts and stuff like that. And for some reason, that's what this reminds me of. I don't know if this is what it is. I tried looking it up and I couldn't find anything that said, you know, the game named Stick'em. It kept giving me all these games about, robberies and things like that, you know, like Stick'em Up type of thing. So I couldn't find something that's called Stick'em, but from what I can see, it does look like a bullseye, because you see a 10, and then below that, I think you see a 20 or 25. Not really sure which of those it is, but you know, it got me thinking about the history of darts and things like that. Do you know anything about the game of darts?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So basically the idea of this game comes from a very long time ago. It's been probably hundreds of years since it was first created as a game. But it only really became popular because, they used to use it for archery and things like that. You'd have a bullseye and stuff like that. But the actual game of darts itself only came into existence around 1896 where people thought of the idea of actually putting points, on the board itself. And the original board used to actually be sections of a tree trunk because of the fact that it has a circular shape and has rings, within the tree when you look at the, when you look at the tree trunk itself.
That's really, really interesting, but it makes a lot of sense that when you think about the shape of a dartboard and the fact that it was on a tree trunk like that.
Correct. Completely. I never thought about it before reading about it this way. The original name for a dartboard was a butt, BUTT,
Oh, wow.
which was taken from the French word BUT, which in French it means it's either the target or the goal. It's pretty funny that English speakers would adapt that, because it definitely doesn't.
Yes, it is.
It doesn't really translate well enough into, or actually not even translating, just using the term, changes the connotation 180 degrees just by thinking about it from that way.
For sure.
Yeah. So before World War One, they used to have dartboards in various pubs in the United Kingdom. And they would mostly use elm trees, as the wood for the thing. But
Okay.
they ran into some problems with it because with so many people throwing darts into them, so the holes created problems. It started cracking and things like that. And sometimes the wood would get too hard, and the darts would bounce off it. So they need to find ways to keep it that things would stay would actually stick into the wood itself. So and the idea of darts themselves were they originally were stubs of arrows or crossbow bolts and things like that. And they started making metal ones in around 1906. But people were still using the wooden ones up until then. Up until the 50s and things like that. But nowadays they're pretty much all made of metal. The reason that we're talking about this now is because this game was they needed to develop a part of it for children. So what they would what they did was is that again it goes back to my memory of as a child that we would have some sort of dartboard that was made of Velcro, where you'd have these balls that you could throw at them, and therefore the balls would stick on it, and that's something that's a little more child friendly than having them throw darts at one another or stuff like that.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go into how the points work and stuff like that because, the scoring, it depends on, where you hit on the dartboard, and there's it's it, it in my eye in or based on my knowledge, it's pretty complicated the way that the way that the numbers are placed around. But, obviously the idea is you need to get the most points. The closest I've come to this in recent years, I've mentioned this in the past, about a year and a half ago when I was visiting the States, I took my son and my nephew, and we went to do axe throwing in a
Ah.
there we found a place that you can throw axes, and basically you get points from the they have a bullseye that you get various points for, stuff like that, which was quite fun to throw axes as opposed to just throwing darts.
Yeah, axe throwing has become like a major recreational activity in like the past within the past 10
Yeah.
years.
Have you ever done
I feel
it?
like it's no, I haven't, but it would be fun. I just haven't, like, I don't really go to bars, and I know that's like a place like they'll have like an axe throwing bar and stuff like that,
Oh, well,
but
no, I wasn't at a bar. We went to an actual place that's what they have. They have axe throwing tournaments and stuff like that. It was like, to me, it was sometimes you go to a bowling alley, and in the bowling alley you have the list of the people who have the most who have bowled the best scores and stuff like that. And here you had the list of the people who threw their axes to get the most points or things like that.
oh,
It was
interesting.
very interesting. I mean, this was in Tom's, was it Tom's River? It was in New Jersey. Oh, it was in Freehold, New Jersey. That's where we went.
Okay.
But they apparently had them all over the country. You can find many places where you can. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you, Emily, that you go somewhere, you spend an hour throwing axes, having fun.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then so the shot changes, and we're back downstairs in the family room. Janie's continuing to play the piano. We see Pete is frustrated as he's trying to write something, apparently his play that he needs to do for Mr. Potter for tomorrow. And Tommy looks like he's playing with a play vacuum cleaner or something like that. Yeah, that's what it looks like. Do you see what I'm talking about?
I didn't know exactly what it was. It looked like this weird, like I didn't dawn on me that it could be a vacuum cleaner. I thought he was like using this weird, like just it looked kind of like a baby lawnmower or something I don't know. But if he's doing the household chores, helping Mary clean up for the party, then that makes total sense that it is a vacuum cleaner. I don't know why I would think it's like a baby lawnmower or something.
I mean, they do have, fake Fisher Price, lawnmowers also, so it could be.
I think
I don't think they had them
a
in
lot more.
1945, but still.
Yeah.
But apparently they did have toys that you can pretend to be vacuuming with. I think.
Yeah, my sister and I had a like a baby fake dirt devil that we would like say that we're vacuuming, but we really didn't get anything.
Hey, if it kept you happy, I think that's the important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he's playing with a fake vacuum cleaner as he's doing that, and then we hear the phone ringing, and all three kids at the same time scream to Mary, telephone, which I can say it happens in my family. None of my kids want to answer the phone. So the phone rings and they're like, telephone, because they say it's not for them, so why should they go bother and answer it? That's yeah. I'm trying to remember if when I was a kid, if I would do things like that. I think if the phone rang, you just answered it, even if it's not for you. Maybe it was because it was in the days before cell phones, where everyone had their own private phone.
I remember my dad says this. We were at a restaurant when I was little. It was this like mom and pop steakhouse, and the phone rang there, and I yelled out, "Phone!" I was like a toddler or something, but I yelled that the phone rang in this restaurant.
That's actually a great
So
story
I definitely
that fits in.
acted just like the kids do in this movie.
That's right. They go, telephone. And Mary looks at them and goes, I'll get it. So she just, walks over and, answers the phone and goes, hello. She goes, yes, this is Mrs. Bailey. Oh, thank you, Mrs. Welch. I'm sure she'll be all right. The doctor said that she ought to be out of bed in time to have her Christmas dinner. I mean, it's just so funny how things have changed in these, dealing with this type of subjects over the last almost 80 years. The way that the teachers and parents talk to one another in a formal way and stuff like that. So
Yeah.
I think it's great to see that at the time this is the way it was. There's, yes, this is Mrs. Bailey. Mrs. Welch called up and said, is Mrs. Bailey there? That type of thing. It wasn't just out of the blue or anything like that. It's not, I'm looking for Mary or I'm looking for Zuzu's mother. I'm looking for Mrs. Bailey.
I know, and the fact that like a teacher is calling the house, you don't really have that anymore. Even with like teacher parent email, I don't know how common that is anymore. Just because if I know anything about public school, I've been almost like a teacher junkie in the sense that I'm friends with some of my former teachers, and because for a while I myself wanted to be a teacher, but just the communication between parents and teachers now is almost non-existent in the sense that not only on personal level but even an academic level, but you look at something like this where the teacher is calling the home of one of their students to make sure that they're okay, to see what happened to them. It's almost unheard of now.
Correct. Correct. Now, I mean, I have a bigger question about it is how does Mrs. Welch actually know that there's a problem with Zuzu? because Zuzu left school, and she didn't button up her coat, and so if one would think that if her teacher saw that she hadn't buttoned up her coat, her teacher would have gone over to her and made sure that she buttoned up. So how would she
Yeah.
know that Zuzu is sick with a cold? To be able to call up and see how she's feeling. You understand what I'm saying there?
Possibly. Well, maybe she saw that she didn't have her coat buttoned because I don't know. I think about like in kindergarten and first grade, we had to like I had a like a very for especially for first grade, I had this like very old school teacher who would probably be fired in today's world for some of her practices in her classroom. But like she would, and this was go okay. So this was like 2002. She would make sure that all the students walking outside had their coats buttoned or zipped up, and that your hat's on your head and you're wearing your gloves and your mittens, and if you brought a scarf, like you're wearing it. But within the confines of that, she also wasn't allowed to like force you. She would make she would she could encourage you to do it, but of course teachers don't like touch students. If you wanted help, you have to ask, can you help me button this, can you help me zip this up? So perhaps Zuzu said no. I don't know if consent was really a, I don't know how common that was in the 1940s, but
Probably not
maybe she told
very.
the teacher.
I mean,
Yeah.
I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and teachers didn't have to ask permission to button up your coat. So it's I mean, nowadays I know that's the way it is, but I don't think in
Yeah.
1945 they had that issue. No, it's an interesting thing to think about, the fact that how did her teacher know that there's a problem? Let's put it that way. Unless Mary left her a message, maybe Mary called her after the doctor came.
Maybe she asked. I think there had to have been like a phone call. Maybe Mary called the teacher asking, like, once she realized Zuzu was sick, like, did she button her coat? Did she, was she coughing at school? Maybe she called her to ask if she was so showing symptoms at home, and then the teacher called her back. So yeah, that's an interesting handling of information.
Again, it's neither here nor there. It's just a fun thing to think about, about how those things play out and where it all came from originally. At this point, George comes back downstairs and he hears that Mary's on the phone, and he goes, "Is that Zuzu's teacher?" And she says, "Yes, let me speak to her." And then he takes the phone from her and goes, "Hello, hello, Mrs. Welch. This is George Bailey. I'm Zuzu's father. Say, what kind of teacher are you anyway? What do you mean sending her home like that, half naked? Do you realize she'll probably end up with pneumonia on account of you?" "George," Mary then tries to stop him, obviously. "Is this the sort of thing that we pay taxes for? To have teachers like you, stupid, silly, careless people who send our kids home without any clothes on? Maybe my kids aren't the best dressed kids, and maybe they don't have any decent clothes. That's stupid." And then Mary basically just grabs the phone away from him before he can continue and say anything that the censors would make sure that wouldn't get into the movie. He's a little bit perturbed here, no question about that.
It's interesting because that's the type of behavior that is more common in today's society when it comes to like parents and teachers' relationships. Like, parents, if they do have any contact with their kid's teacher, it's, well, what did you do to my kid? What are you teaching them? What goes on in your classroom? That I feel like that's a more that happens a lot more today than it did back then. It's just interesting how that scene has become more less, well, it's become more and more relevant as time goes on, unfortunately.
Now they the whole thing that the parents interfere more
Yes.
with the learning process, I guess you can say, because they seek out the what the kids the what ki the rights of the kids, I guess you can say. So yeah, the
I think it's interesting that there's been that shift and what's caused that shift, and it's I don't want to get into it because it would be quite depressing, but it's part of the reason why I don't want to be a teacher anymore is because of everything that goes on like that. But yeah.
Right. Okay. I can understand that. I definitely can understand that. And I just find it really interesting that on the one hand he says, that why is she sending her home half naked? And then after that, he basically says that, why would you send her kids home without any clothes on? So he's taking this a little bit to the extreme, even with his complaint. I mean, he does have a legitimate claim about a complaint about the fact that she came home with her jacket open. Yes, no question about that. But someone with their jacket open does not mean that they are naked. And it
He's acting like the jacket was the only piece of clothing she wore to school.
correct. And it, so it's, first of all, he says half naked, and then he says, without any clothes on. So it's a little bit of a stretch. There's no question about that. But he's also, riled up about the whole thing because he just came from her room and saw how she's feeling. And you also see the contrast between them about the way that he was acting in the room with her. And then him coming downstairs and he's now fuming again. He was nice and calm when he was with her in the room by herself. He was calm, unlike with his other kids. When the other kids were wanted things, he got agitated and started complaining. But here with Zuzu,
Definitely.
he's very calm. No arguments from him when it comes to that. Which again, it says a lot about who George Bailey is. No, but he really just
Yes.
got.
Oh no, I was just saying yes. I just it's completely agreeable. And again, that's what Capra was able to do with that character is keep that humanity about George and keep the professionalism and be that all American, just upright, genuinely good human being about him. It's a difficult thing to do, I think, to portray like someone who's really not someone who's losing it, but also can keep part of their composure together.
Right, but do you think that's more of the ability of Capra, or the more the ability of Stewart to be able to do that, or a combination of the two?
Oh man, it's probably it, I think it has to be a combination of the two because you think about Jimmy Stewart and his entire career and what he's been able to do, but then you look at Frank Capra and the themes that he's been kept in his movies, and it definitely has to be a combination of the two. And when you put them together, that's part of why we're talking about this film right now, nearly like over 75 years later.
Correct. Yeah, because it's such a timeless film that the theme is still relevant today as it was back then. And especially, I mean, what we've been talking about this week, we've seen that most of these things are relatively similar to what goes on in regular households in today's day and age. So, it sometimes it's amazing to see. I mean, when Capra made this, he didn't know that. He didn't know that this would be something that would be so timeless, but apparently it is. Mary is able to take the phone away from George, and she goes, "Hello, Mrs. Welch. I want to apologize. Hello, hello." She hung up. We talked about this a few weeks ago when George hung up the phone on Potter. Actually, it was a few months ago by now. But it's the same thing here. The whole idea of you constantly pressing on, the button on the phone, hoping that someone will still be there, even after you think that they've hung, or even after they've hung up. And after Mary says she's hung up, so George shouts out, "I'll hang her up." And
Ooh.
then we can actually hear a voice on the phone, and thanks to the subtitles, we know what that voice says. The voice says, "Hey, you, I'll knock your block off." What's that? So I'm assuming you've heard the phrase before, "knock your block off," right?
Yes.
Do you know what it means? And do you know how far back it goes?
Yeah. I know what it means, I just don't know how far back it goes within society, vernacular, I guess. But yeah, I definitely heard it before.
Right. It basically means to strike a person in the head, causing them to fall to the ground, especially in an unconscious condition, or to beat up a person. And the reason that the term block is the same as head, so it's I'll knock his block off basically means I will knock his head off. And that's something that the idiom dates from around the 1900s, around 1900 itself, which is similar to the idea of beat the living daylights out of somebody and stuff like that. These are the similar types of comments that one could say, the idea of knocking someone's block off. And then George takes the phone and says, "Hello, who's this?" And people are going to have to actually come back on Monday to find out who George seems to be yelling at over the phone. So, Emily, did you have anything else you wanted to say about this minute or anything else about the movie in general?
No, not in particular. It's just now it talking about all of this makes me want to watch the movie because, like I said, I this past Christmas season I just didn't get a chance to watch it, but now I'm definitely gonna want to sit down and watch it because I usually only watch it like once a year, but it definitely the movie it transcends Christmas or cold or the time it was made. You can just watch it any time of year and take it in and just appreciate it for what it is. So now I definitely want to watch the movie.
Good. I'm glad that I
Sit down
convinced
and
you
watch.
to want to go rewatch it again. Not just the
Yes.
minutes that we're talking about, but the entire 132 minutes. There you
Most definitely.
go. Okay, great. So every Friday we have a segment called Oscar Oops, where the idea is that over the last 95 years of the Oscars, there are always many controversies as to which movies did win, should have won, deserved to have won, but didn't, things like that. So, the idea of this segment is that my guests can then discuss their top five movies that they think should have won Best Picture, but did not. But it has to be something that was nominated.
Okay, so with number five, I wrote down Apollo 13. I've just always wondered. Now I'm not really a big fan of Mel Gibson, so perhaps I'm biased. But how did Apollo 13 not win? I just don't know. It's always been something on my mind because I think Apollo 13 is an interesting movie based on something so close to our society. Like there's people alive today who remember when that happened. I just don't, and most definitely more, even more people alive in 1995 when it came out. So I just never understood why it didn't win. At number four, and I know why this movie did not win just due to the political climate of the time. I wrote down High Noon from 1952. A lot of controversy with that movie. Even still today, and I get why it didn't win and why The Greatest Show on Earth did win. But I've always felt like I've never seen Greatest Show on Earth, but it just feels like an obligatory movie to me. Like, oh, I gotta watch this because it won Best Picture Oscar. But I don't know if it's dated very well, like if it's still as enjoyable today as it was back
Well,
then.
it's one of Steven Spielberg's favorite movies, which is what he talked about in The Fablemans, but it's not one of it's not among the best pictures for sure. But it's a fun movie to watch if you enjoy the idea of the circus, because they show you how a circus moves and things, everything that goes on behind the scenes at a circus. That type of thing. And you get Jimmy Stewart playing a clown.
Yes, as a clown, yeah. But yeah, but again, I understand why High Noon didn't win because even today people talk about the controversy of High Noon and it being un-American. Is it really, I mean, that symbol of Gary Cooper throwing his badge on the ground, how American is that? How what kind of morals is that? I get it why it didn't win, but I personally like High Noon. Number three, but then again, I will say I love Rio Bravo too. So for me, there isn't an argument.
Okay.
Just wanted to make that
Yeah.
clear.
Rio Bravo is one of my
Number
favorite
three,
westerns. I'm a very big fan of Rio Bravo.
oh, for sure. I got to see it on the big screen in 2022.
Oh,
It was just
very cool.
number three. I wrote down The Awful Truth from 1937. I've always loved The Awful Truth. The movie that did win, what was it? That movie with Paul Muni, I believe.
That
The Life of a
the
Mutant.
Emil Zola.
Yes. I mean, I get why that won, but again, I feel as if The Awful Truth has dated better. But it's always interesting to see what is remembered versus what movie is only remembered because it won an award. I always find that such an interesting contrast. But The Awful Truth being a comedy, I can see why it didn't win. Like, people just write it off as like, oh, that comedy with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne, whereas
The
Emile
life of
Zola is
Emil
like that
Zola.
serious.
Right.
Yes, it's that serious biopic that was probably very talked about back in
Well, it
1937.
was all about the Dreyfus affair. So yeah.
Yes, and then number two, I wrote down A Place in the Sun, 1951. I forget what won in 1951, but it must have not been very memorable in my mind. What did win for 1951?
Right, so the winner in 1951 was An American in Paris.
Okay. I do not like American in Paris. I've got nothing against Gene Kelly. I've got nothing against it. It was just I just think it was a I was shocked that a musical could win Best Picture over something like A Place in the Sun. That's probably what threw me. And like a musical won Best Picture. Not that it's an impossible feat. It's just I thought that, A Place in the Sun was that more serious drama where you had a lot of substance to it. But maybe it's because I don't really like An American in Paris, like I
Okay,
said.
that's fair.
And then A Place in the Sun, it's just one of those interesting movies about it's a very American story. I mean, it was based off the movie or the book or the source material of an American tragedy. And then the first one I wrote down, it was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid from 1969. I am very surprised that it didn't win and that Midnight Cowboy won. And Midnight Cowboy, I've never seen it, but from what I understand, it's not even a
No,
Western.
not at all.
See, I'm because Butch Cassidy is that beloved buddy film Western that like it was just a great pairing of Newman and Redford, and I mean, again, maybe people couldn't take it seriously enough because it had that humor and it was a Western and genre pictures. Again, they don't really win Best Picture award. But yeah, I was very I would have voted for Butch Cassidy in 1969 for sure.
Okay. That is a great list. Very nice. Okay, so Emily, would you like for one final time to tell people where they can find you?
Okay, so I'm at YouTube under my name, Emily Graziano, and then I have a film blog, the Flapperdame film.wordpress.com. And then I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at FlapperDame16. That's the same for both platforms. And I just want to say that this has been a really great experience and that I've learned a lot and that it was really fun because I've actually never done like a film podcast before. I've been invited on other podcasts, but it's always been like a music based thing. So this is my first film invite. So I that's such an honor for
Well,
me.
it's my honor to have had you on. I mean, I knew that It's a Wonderful Life is one of your favorite movies, which is why I invited you. Part of the idea of this is to get people to talk about it, talk about movies that they love. It's sort of preaching to the choir a little bit, because of the fact that most of my guests like the movie that we talk about, whatever it is, throughout the seasons that I've been doing. But you want to talk about movies that you like, not necessarily. The idea is not to rip open a movie. The idea is to, savor in everything that happens and dive deep into it and get a better understanding of the various possibilities of what they were trying to do when they made the movie and what they were trying to tell us, or a lot of things that they weren't trying to tell us that they didn't notice themselves that maybe we will notice, that type of thing. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us for this week. So thank you, Emily.
Oh, so much fun. Oh, thank you.
Right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So I will be back on Monday, but until then, hot dog.
Hot
I
dog.
love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.